Hello, lovely Squawker Talker listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker football podcast. My name is Jake Entwistle, and although we are coming to you a day later than usual, it's for good reason. We have a very special project in the works at Squawker, and it meant that Monday was a no-go zone. And it's also a reason why I'm only joined by two guests again this week. But what a pair of guests they are. First of which is chief writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. Welcome.
I'm glad to be on the Squawker Talker Football Podcast again, as always.
Yeah. I was going to say, you must be 100%.
Well, no, I did miss one. Remember when my child was born? So I think that was, you know, that was all right, I suppose. But other than that, yes.
That was an authorized leave of absence. There's a tease for some later content. The second guest on the podcast is Sam Long, rich content editor at Squawker. Are you rich?
I'm not rich.
I always thought
I'm rich in content.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, there we go.
And that's the only currency that matters. But on this week's podcast, of course, there is only one place to start. USA are officially the most dominant nation in women's football. Most goals scored in a tournament. As many titles as every other nation combined. Back-to-back champions. Jill Ellis, the first manager to do that. And in fact, their 12-game World Cup winning streak is a feat never before achieved in the men's or women's game. Brazil produced 11 between 2002 and 2006, but then met Zidane's France in the semi-final. And we are recording on the anniversary of Zidane then going on to headbutt Marco Materazzi. It was the quarterfinal of the Brazil one.
Yes. There you go. They played Portugal in the semis.
Even earlier, sorry, but we are recording on a headbutt into a chest of an Italian defender, which is great. One World Cup memory to another. But at the forefront of the Women's World Cup was one woman standing tall, arms outstretched. No shame about who she is or what she stood for, which was super refreshing to see in this day and age. Megan Rapinoe, Golden Boot winner, Golden Ball winner, the first USA player to start three World Cup finals. She delivered from the spot in the final, picked up those two individual awards. Was this the World Cup that will be remembered as Megan Rapinoe's World Cup, Mo?
Oh, without question. Because, you know, when you talk about, is it their, quote-unquote, their World Cup, it's not just about how well they play. So, I mean, obviously, yeah, you have World Cups where you're the best player on the pitch throughout the tournament. It's their World Cup, right? But 2006, as good as the Italians were, for example, that's Zidane's World Cup.
For one of the reasons we just mentioned.
For headbutting Materazzi, that no one remembers the Italian players. I mean, maybe Cannavaro for that amazing Italian commentary, the semi-final against Germany. If you haven't found that, check that out. It's very good. But no, it's... Rapinoe was... Look, she's six goals. Five of them in the knockout rounds. She won them the round of 16 against Spain. She won the quarterfinal against France. I mean, didn't play against him. This is how important she was. She had a slight hamstring knock, apparently. So they rested her against semi-final. I mean, that speaks to the USA's strength as a squad. Yeah. They could rest her.
That also sort of ended up being why she won the Golden Boot as well. She won it on less minutes played, didn't she?
Yeah, because her and Alex Morgan both had six goals, three assists.
Well, the thing is, this is another where the stats worlds collide. FIFA notoriously are quite favourable with their assists. And our opta-defined assist, Megan Rapinoe actually only had two. So could this be a conspiracy theory that she didn't even deserve the Golden Ball?
Retract the award.
Give it to Ellen White, who got no assists.
Yes. It would be Alex Morgan's, wouldn't it?
But Ellen White, yeah. I think now Golden Boot, you could maybe give VAR waiting. How many goals did they get taken away unfairly? Because Ellen White would have steamed away with the award with that. But sorry, focusing back onto Megan Rapinoe, obviously, as we said... scored all of her penalties, which again, although the sort of joke about taking penalties, someone has to do it. As we saw with England, you can miss penalties.
It sounds easy, you know, take penalties, take penalties. But, you know, you look at the Marta missed one, you know, Mars, you know, people miss penalties all the time. Great players miss penalties all the time. You know, look at the Copa America, you know, Leo Messi, you know, great players can miss penalties. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to score them. Rapinoe scored the one in the final, I thought was amazing because she very clearly faked it to the go one way. Very pressure penalty because the USA did not look like they were going to... They weren't steamrolling into things. It looked like they were really having to labour for it.
Well, this is the thing. It was the first time they hadn't scored in within 12 minutes.
Yeah.
But it was the first time in 14 games they hadn't scored in the first half. So this was a dogged Netherlands display.
They really held... The Netherlands defended very well. And the Americans were sort of like... They didn't really... The one thing you can say about the Americans where they're getting is to rough them up a little bit, get a bit physical with them. I mean, they don't shy away from the challenge, but it does put them out of their rhythms somewhat. And the Dutch did that very well. They committed bodies back very well. The 4-4-1-1 was a very smart decision, tactically contained them, but they found a way through. You know, you can't argue it was a penalty. It's harsh because,
clumsy, wasn't it?
Yeah, she's not looking to foul the player, but, you know, when you put your foot that high, you know, you don't do that in the penalty box, you know, because it's just you run the risk. And Alex Morgan, you know, collision, it's a penalty. It's a harsh penalty, but it's a penalty. Yeah, Rapina just, she sent Van Veenendaal the wrong way, which was, I mean, Van Veenendaal was having an amazing game. Mm. Like, she was lights out. You think, I almost thought she might save it, frankly, because she'd been that good. But no, Rapina scored it. And, you know, it's not just the quality of her play. I mean, you know, the quality of her play is good. She created two of the best chances in the first half with some left foot crosses. She's just been such an icon of the tournament, standing up to Donald Trump in a way that no political leaders had the guts to do. Taking on, just being proudly LGBT, which is, which is, you'd think is not a big deal, but it is.
Yeah, definitely. I think there was that, she got told of the quote, didn't she? And then she said, you can't win a World Cup without gays in your squad. And they went on to win it and proved it just right. And even the US women's Twitter account then replied and did sort of, as we call it, a rebang and said, told you.
Yeah.
So it was perfect. She stood up for so many important values, as well as just absolutely bossing it on the pitch.
And great celebration too.
Well, this is what I mean, is that it was the complete package, because and I feel bad for not remembering the tweet because there were so many flowing through, but someone said it was one of the greatest talk the talk, walk the walk tournaments. And I think that perfectly summed it up, in the sense that she was very outspoken, very confident in the US ability and her own ability, but they delivered and they were by far the best team, which was, again, evident in the awards. She picked up the golden ball. Alex Morgan was then silver boot, Ellen White bronze boot. But sort of moving on to the rest of the tournament holistically and just the individual talent that was there, we've got down as a question, was Megan Rapinoe actually deserving of the golden ball? I think we've covered it there, that when you score 5 knockout goals and you lead your team to the tournament you probably deserve it. But Lucy Bronze was the first English player to ever be named in a top 3 at a Women's World Cup. Again, we spoke about her on the preview pod about potentially being Lucy Golden Ball. And I said, which pun will we be tweeting out? So we got to use the silver one instead, despite not winning a bronze medal. Is that a sign that despite finishing fourth, Sam, this England team, in perhaps other areas beyond just on the pitch and ranking of best teams, because they're fourth this year, whereas in 2015 they were third. Mm. Is this a sign, though, that the talent of individuals is increasing, and also that there is progress to be proud of for England during this World Cup?
Yeah, it's definitely progress to be proud of. Of course, they didn't get their hands on a medal, so purely on the pitch, they've regressed. Mm. But if you look at the impact that they've made among the wider audience, it's huge. You know, the viewing figures, record viewing figures, making a breakthrough into the mainstream. And that's why I think Phil Neville's comment about the third place playoff being a nonsense game was a little bit misjudged. Alex Scott said in commentary as well that her third place finish took pride of place on her mantelpiece compared to even some of the stuff that she's won with Arsenal, because of the impact that it made on the nation as a whole, and the fact that there were going to be little girls out there seeing what they'd achieved and being inspired to play the game, which is a win. Okay, it's not a win on the pitch, but it is.
And it set the platform for this, again, which we said, as you said, so many more people encapsulated by the tournament, an incredible BBC montage at the end of it. People wanted to watch the World Cup, Women's World Cup, and they did watch it.
See, this is what I'm saying. This is why, for me, I think Phil Neville, you should sack him. If you want to go for want to progress. Look, because he talks like he's a Premier League manager. It's a nonsense game. No, it's not. It's the World Cup purpose playoff. You lost. Get over it. Like, accept that you lost the game. It's like the idea that, especially because before the game, he was like, we're gonna go out and win it. We're going to take it to, you know. So he just says whatever comes into his head. Like, he doesn't actually have any sort of, the man is just all platitudes, right? He's like a Gareth Southgate tribute band. He's an Oasis, right? You know, not an Oasis tribute band. Gareth Southgate is out there, you know, swaggering Liam Gallagher, Noel Gallagher, really entertaining, brilliant, and genuine, right? The things he says are genuine. You believe them, and the transmits to the players. Phil Neville is like some sort of tribute act, you know. He's come out suddenly, starts dressing like Gareth Southgate. Yeah. It's like he tries to talk like it, but he doesn't actually have anything. He doesn't believe any of the stuff he's saying. You can tell it's just like he's, this is the most proudest thing of my life. You know,
to play devil's advocate here, I genuinely have a bit of sympathy in that, because he actually did care, that was a major, and it's a big blunder, and that word now can't be taken away. But I feel like it was a very emotional reaction.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And looking straight back, he'll be like, game, yeah. Oh, why did I say it was a nonsense? And perhaps even it was taken out of context and he meant the game in itself in that 90 minutes. Mm. They didn't play well. England didn't play well. Perhaps he meant it was a nonsense there. Do you know what I mean?
It's so difficult to judge those third place games because it's almost like who is feeling more hurt after the semi-final defeat. Yeah. England had their eyes on the final. Sweden were probably a bit more... just happy to have reached the semi-final.
And it's just that thing, it's the same with the Community Shield, isn't it? If you win it, you've won a trophy. If you've lost it, you haven't lost anything.
It's a strange thing, but look, ultimately, I just think Neville has shown throughout the entire tournament that he doesn't really have any sort of great tactical idea. It's more just he has a very... You mentioned about England, the talent in England squad. There's no doubt it's more talented than it was 4 years ago. Stupendous amount of talent. Lucy Bronze, one of the best players in the world. You know, Tony Duggan, I mean, she wasn't fully fit, but she's really good. Nikita Paris is sensational. Ellen White has turned into some sort of like Ruud van Nistelrooy.
She was just like
unreal in the box.
I wanted her to get a golden boot because I feel like the graphic that one of our designers, Joe, made so it was inspired by the Dortmund TIFO. So it's got the flag of her doing her celebration in the background. And I'm actually physically doing the celebration again on an audio platform.
It's a great celebration.
The John Joe Shelby celebration.
It's a very, very good celebration.
Or Ellen White is Anthony Modeste.
Ellen White is a really, she's really developed. A magnificent forward. Your Scott is just Mrs. Reliable, just phenomenal in midfield, just every time. Steph Houghton, I mean, look, you know, when you're having to carry someone like Millie Bright, I think Steph Houghton had a really great tournament considering that, because Millie Bright did not have a good tournament. Steph Houghton was like... She made some blunders there. She didn't, but she played out of her mind for most of the time, just to make up for the fact that Millie Bright wasn't.
She wouldn't have
even
had an opportunity to miss the penalty if it wasn't for her two goal line clearances against Norway.
Well, exactly. So there's so much talent in the England team, so much talent that it's just baffling that it's been made so little use of. There are a lot of people that are arguing that Jill Ellis, for instance, with the Americans, isn't necessarily a great tactical mind, but she's very good at motivating her players to play for her in the way that in the men's game Deschamps is, you know, for France. Like, not a great, you know, and that's fine. That really works if you have a very super talented squad of players, right? Yeah. So England clearly have that. But I don't think Neville is necessarily the best. He's a decent motivator, I think, but I don't, from what I watch of England, They get by on talent alone. Mm. And that's okay for most games. But if you're not as overwhelmingly superior as the USA are.
Well, this is what
France,
I mean. USA have a squad.
Yeah.
Their whole squad was
incredible.
They
barely played Mallory Pugh in the tournament. Mm. Like, she's phenomenal. So, it's just... And they play Crystal Dunn at left back. Yeah. And she's a number 10.
Yeah.
But England did beat the USA before the World Cup, didn't they? So it's not like Neville's reign needs to be solely judged on this. Because ahead of the World Cup, I would say that England... We're right up there. Yeah.
No. They're a good side, but that's based on talent. And regarding the winner in the She Believes Cup, it's like someone said, beating the USA in a friendly is completely different to beating the USA in a competitive tournament. They are completely different beasts when it comes to actual competitive football, especially World Cup.
They were hell bent on winning this World Cup.
They're the standard bearers of the game, aren't they? Yeah. So really, it's positive that England are holding themselves to their standards and comparing.
England perhaps would have made the final if they were on the other side. And I know that doesn't mean anything, but England were the fourth best and they lost to Sweden. But as you said, Sam, perhaps they took that USA defeat really bad, considering the circumstances, and just couldn't quite get up for it. When in another day, they could have, as we said, not in a tournament, but they've beaten the US before. So there's definitely platform to build on. The final person I want to mention before we do a little sort of fun interaction with the listeners, Rose Lavelle picked up the bronze ball. Megan Rapinoe, again, was so good with her words as well as her feet, said that she's not just a superstar for the future.
She's not a superstar in the making. She is a superstar. Yeah. And that's 100% true. Rose Lavelle, for me, if you're talking about consistently, consistent performance, I think she was probably the best player at the tournament. Sam Muse was also very, very good, but I don't think she wasn't in the semi-final, didn't play so well. Rose Lavelle, sensational. And it's crazy that the USA benched Lindsey Horan, who is like one of the best midfielders in the world, for the last three games, I want to say, or they spent the same one. I can't remember. But basically,
they rotate so much that it's hard.
And
to...
they barely played in. They didn't play her in the final for sure. Yeah, and didn't miss her. Mm. That's crazy. That's genuinely crazy to be able to do that. And that speaks to Roosevelt's ability to carry the ball in all tournament. I mean, Rapinoe just said it all, so you just go back and listen to what she said. Yeah. But Roosevelt carried the ball so excellently all tournament. Carried the ball from defence to attack, through midfield, through lines, breaking presses, distributing the ball to the forwards so well. And for her to finish the tournament, finish the game with that goal was just so perfect. It's a beautiful goal, wonderful, wonderful dribble. The way she steps over it to wrong foot the defender to give herself the space to dip into. And the finish was just brilliant, beautiful, thwapped right
buried
to the...
It
was really, really nice. Not about power, a little bit of power, but about precision.
Poise
and precision. And she's just a really, really graceful player to watch.
That's the thing is, we were talking about, obviously I spoke up Carolina Graham-Hansen throughout the tournament her ability to dribble. Rose Lavelle, especially against England, I don't think we ever got within 2 yards.
And she's 24 years old. Exactly. Most of that American team is very old. Like they're 30 years, around 30 years. Yeah. They're veterans. They know how to do things. She's 24 years old. This is her first World Cup. She's really good.
She'll be the flag bearer for getting the three-peat, I think, in the future.
100%.
But to wrap up, obviously, as we've said, an incredible tournament. USA deserve winners. Some brilliant individual displays. The birth of genuine icons, I think, through celebrations, through performances. And as we've said, even makes it even more exciting about the World Cup in the next few years, given the likes of Rose Lavelle breaking through. But I tasked you all with just finding your little favourite stat of the tournament. And then we're going to ask voters on Instagram to say which was their favourite little stat. So I hope you've come with a little nugget of information. Sam, we'll start with you. What did you find the most intriguing? And these weren't necessarily mind-blowing stats. These were just what you liked the best.
Yeah, so mine is just 9.58% of the goals scored at the tournament came from outside the penalty area.
There you go.
And just two teams scored more than one goal from outside the area, and they were Australia and Italy.
Make the goals bigger.
Well, that's it.
Yeah. Mo, yours?
Only four teams at their World Cup overperformed their XG, their expected goals. So, 24 teams at the tournament, only four of them overperformed their expected goals by a margin greater than one. So there were seven overperformed their XG, but there was like by 0.1 or 0.9, which is still a big difference, but only four overperformed their XG by more than one. So USA, obviously 5.6, they overperformed their expected goals by 5.6. Expected to score 20.4, score 26, right? Kind of figured, right? Italy. Next. Expected to score 7.9, scored 9. They're very good tournament, very impressive. Australia. Expected to score 7.1, scored 9. Sam Kerr, phenomenal tournament again.
Most shots on target in the tournament.
Yeah, but my favourite, Argentina. Expected to score 1.9 goals, they scored 3.
There you go.
Get in there.
So, because that's going to be really difficult to write down. I will probably just go with the Argentina nugget out of that.
Fair enough.
And of course, they are brilliant. They got their first clean sheet at the tournament as well.
It was great watching them. They weren't good to watch, but it was great watching
them. It was fun, not because of the football, but because of the furor of when they were playing. And obviously, incredible goalkeeping.
Everything they've overcome as well. Sleeping in a coach, no funding from the AFA. They're a really positive tragedy.
We know what you're trying to... My one, obviously, it's to do an individual, and it's my favourite because it literally is exactly what you'd expect. Wendy Renard did not lose a single aerial duel the entire World Cup and contested more without losing a header than any other player. She won 17 out of 17 aerial duels at the tournament, which I just think was just poetic because that's exactly what you'd expect, which shows that stats do tell stories, everyone. We're going to move on from one tournament to another, but before that we'll have a little quick break and then, as I said, come back for some Copa America action. As promised, some Copa America chat now. But before we actually dive into it, we did have a listener's question saying, why did FIFA allow two other finals to be scheduled on the same day? That was by Just Cuda. And obviously, this is another reason why the podcast had to be delayed, because we wanted to centralise our thoughts, trying to digest three tournaments. And we're not actually going to be talking about the Gold Cup because of that. So it makes it even worse. They've denied Mexico and USA a place on the Squawker Talker football podcast by scheduling three finals on the same day. So do you think this was, again, to bring her up again, Megan Rapinoe had some strong views on it, said it was pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, it's a massive oversight on FIFA's part, but is it any surprise? It's almost what we've come to expect from that organisation, really. I've seen some sort of arguments that, oh, men's finals don't always get their own day on the calendar, like the FA Cup final, but the World Cup final has to have its own day. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it worked out not as bad as it, when you were thinking there's three finals, there was enough of a gap to enjoy the Women's World Cup.
Well, the kickoff times were kind for a UK audience, weren't they?
Yeah.
But they could have been, you know, awful for other parts of the world.
I just mean that there was enough of a gap to sort of get in for the celebrations to be broadcast and to be enjoyed before everyone diverted their attention to Brazil.
It was great to see Infantino get his fair share of heckling, though.
Yeah, it wasn't a good day for people in power getting receptions. I think in Brazil's Copa America win, there was not a kind reception.
It's disappointing to see all the squad shake his hand, though, and let him insert himself into that when he had absolutely nothing to do with anything.
To be fair to certain players, I know some people actually are in support of him. It's difficult in that situation to know what to do, especially when you've just won a tournament.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you look at the courage Megan Rapinoe's had, even after something she said, look, I hadn't spoken to everyone about it, but most of us will not be going. She knows she's not going, and she knows she has no intention or no desire to share any sort of space with Trump. Now, I get it. Bolsonaro inserted himself into Brazil. He was very much like pushed himself in there, but they didn't have to shake his hand. They didn't have to. I know we probably would have caused a national incident, but it's about courage of your convictions. Yeah. Megan Rapinoe was like very brave, and her Brazilian players just, even if they didn't want to necessarily, like there was a whole thing about Marquinhos didn't do it, but then he did. You should see he did. He shook his hand. It's very
difficult, and to be honest, the politics of it all in football makes, this is the Squawker Talker football podcast, and as much as it seems it's good to address those, Brazil did win the Copa America, Bolsonaro did insert himself in the celebrations, but they were celebrations because Brazil won the match, and in the process of that, Dani Alves became... Well, he extended his record as the most decorated player in history. There were reports it was his 40th and the first player to win 40, but there are numerous titles, regional titles when he started in Brazil that are excluded and included no matter where you look. So basically, Dani Alves has 40 plus titles.
He's won a lot.
And he was also named player of the tournament, which was... deserved, I feel.
Definitely. I mean, if only for his involvement in Brazil's goal against Argentina.
Yeah, drilling through, no-look passes. And he's a free agent. So are we looking at the greatest right-back in football ever? A free agent.
Yeah, I've always said he's Messi and a right-back, right? He's more than a right-back. It's not just that he's a right-back, he's a right-winger, he's a right midfielder. It's quite absurd that both he and Sadi van Veenendaal in the Women's World Cup are both free agents. Someone's going to get some bargains there.
Yeah.
Like Van Veenendaal had an amazing final in the Women's World Cup. And then Dani Alves, you know, just, I mean, he's sensational. He's when he's playing for his future, there's no one in the world like that can come close, as a right back, can come close to him. Even now. When he's secure in his future, he's 36 now, I think. Yeah, he slows down. It's very obvious. Like at Barcelona for the last 2 years of his Barca, 3 years of his Barca career, he didn't really play at his level. He was still very good.
Yeah.
Didn't play near his peak until spring of 2015, when his contract was running at the end of the season. Suddenly it's like, oh my God, Dani Alves went crazy.
Well, this came up, didn't it, this morning before the podcast? Because I saw a clip that Sid Lowe retweeted, and it was in Spanish. So I just sort of took it upon myself because I found it really interesting to translate it as well. And it was Dani Alves talking about how at Barcelona, Pep Guardiola was adamant that the right back should only really pass to the midfielder or a centre-back to progress the ball. And Dani Alves said... he used to pass to Messi directly a lot, and Pep Guardiola once pulled him aside and said, "Danny, can we not do that?" And he said, "Well, if Messi's out of the game for 2 minutes, I think it's my duty to get him back involved in the game. Otherwise, how is he going to then win the game for us if he disconnects? So I play those passes to keep him in the game." And again, it wasn't like, "Oh, Pep Guardiola told me to do it." It was just like a discussion of yes, I understand your philosophy, yeah. but here's my understanding on the pitch, I which think, is what makes him so great.
I think that fed into, personality, understanding the pitch. I think that fed into Messi playing false nine as well. I would imagine it did because it's, you pull Messi deeper and then suddenly he can exchange those passes with Dani Alves, and it's not a midfielder passing to a forward. It's basically a fullback passing to a midfielder. He's best when Messi basically played. Alves is a really quite a special and unique talent. He's a really wild kind of character. Yeah. It's crazy that he's a free agent because I think there's so much he offers to many teams. You know, there's a lot of teams that could use him. And even if you want to use him in less, I want to say a backup role, but like if you know you have a main guy chugging along and then you have him playing odd game here and there, you could use him in midfield. I mean, it's not the best.
Well, PSG had to use him in midfield last season.
It's not the best thing in the world because he is a right back, not a midfielder. But like Man City, if they could get him in. I mean, Liverpool, if they could get him in, I mean, you know, to rotate with Trent, that would be something. Because he could teach Trent so much.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you look at what Trent can do as a player, and he's not a great defender, but he's amazing going forward, but he's good one-on-one. That's Dani Alves. He was never a great positional defender, very good one-on-one defending, and amazing going forward. He could teach Trent, like, oh my goodness.
Big wages, though.
That's a stumbling block. He's Dani Alves is a man, as we've said, has won 40 trophies. He's done everything. done everything he needs to do in football. Yeah. So
two trebles. You know,
in a professional capacity, what he's looking for next is one final contract to make sure that he lives.
I don't wonder if he goes back to Barcelona. I mean, given everyone is apparently going back to Barcelona this summer.
The reports are linking that, as you've mentioned, Liverpool are there. And I like that comparison with Alexander-Arnold in the sense that we've spoken about him so much coming into midfield and playing those passes. Yeah. And he plays those direct passes to Firmino that Dani Alves says Pep Guardiola to this day does not like.
And he's such a Klopp guy, isn't he? Like, can you not just see him and Klopp being like the best of friends?
Just
Dani Alves and Klopp.
Imagine the hugs.
Yeah.
There would be some outrageous hug sequences with those two in the team. But moving on from Dani Alves, who, as I said, was named best player in the tournament, could he be joining up with the best goalkeeper in the Copa America? Alisson picks up his third, not Golden Glove, his third goalkeeping award in a sense. Kept the most clean sheets in the Premier League this season. Made the most saves in the Champions League as they went on to lift their sixth title. Joint most clean sheets with Ter Stegen, playing more games. And then obviously at the Copa America, conceded just the one goal in the final to Paulo Guerrero, who himself is a Copa America legend, the highest active scorer in the competition. So it was nice that he was the one to beat Alisson, albeit from the spot. Alisson denied a place in history, though, as Colombia have actually won the Copa America without conceding a single goal. So Alisson couldn't repeat that feat, but in third, not 36, he kept 36 clean sheets for club and country throughout 2018-19 and conceded 36 goals. So Alisson Becker has had a phenomenal season, perhaps established himself as the number one, through the lens of accomplishment within the team combined with individual.
I mean, when you're putting up Simeone numbers and you're not playing for Simeone, you have to be impressed.
Yeah.
Like that's 36 goals conceded, 36 clean sheets. That's Diego Simeone numbers.
Well, it is. The nature of to look for that angle is born out of an Oblak stat that I once found, that was the fact that he'd kept more clean sheets than conceded goals. Yeah. So not quite Simeone yet, but this is the discussion now. We spoke about how Van Dijk established himself as a low-key Ballon d'Or contender because of success and incredible individual talent. Then we spoke about Bernardo Silva ticking all the boxes in terms of multiple titles, incredible individual talent. Alisson now, and again, this is an important distinction to make, the Ballon d'Or, as we've said, doesn't really make sense. So when we talk about it, we like to look at it through the lens of how they try and judge it. Alisson now, he made 8 saves in the Champions League final, the first goalkeeper to keep a clean sheet in a final since Julio Cesar. Golden Glove in his first season in the Premier League, the most saves in the Champions League, conceded one goal in an international tournament and lifted the trophy. He's ticking those boxes, Sam.
He is ticking them, but I think the one he doesn't tick is purely just the position that he plays. I don't think we're ready to see another goalkeeper win the Ballon d'Or. I think there's only been one back in 1963. So he's been good. I mean, the statistics you've reeled off there are incredible. But is he good enough to be crowned the best player in the world?
I think what hurts him is that Liverpool have Van Dijk. So it's like, you know how sometimes you hear about splitting the vote, like in Man United 1999, didn't win, it was David Ginola, one player of the year. because all the main lineup players were so good, they split the vote between them, right? So Alisson and Van Dijk, who do you credit for Liverpool's defensive success?
Yep.
It's like, if Van Dijk hadn't had a great season, it had just been Alisson and Mohamed Salah, then you can see, yeah, he'd get on the podium. But now it's like, who gets on the podium? You know, Van Dijk or Alisson? And I don't know which one of them will. I think one of them will do.
Yeah,
probably going to be Van Dijk because he's better looking and he's an actual player. It's just like, look, it's a stupid thing. Look, man, I love it. Alisson is, I mean, you know, there's that the Muddy Waters song, Manish Boy, you know, I'm a man. I think that should just play behind Alisson whenever he stands anywhere because he's just so manly. But at the same time, being real, Van Dijk, look, man, Troy Deeney said he smells nice. I can't think of any bigger compliment to any player ever.
You can tell that we think the Ballon d'Or might not just be judging the best player in the world when we've decided that handsomeness and scent is a deciding factor.
Beard, beard.
Well, he's got a good beard. He's got a Messi has shaved, so that should give him an edge, really.
Van Dijk wins it. Oh no. Wait, that's what I mean. Van Dijk can't be on the podium.
That's what I'm saying. Well, maybe the beardness gives Alisson an edge now because the rest of them are clean shaven. Really.
In terms of boxes tick, it goes beyond the trophies and the style. We've said that aesthetically he ticks the boxes for Ballon d'Or, apparently. But all joking aside, I drew up potentially the 5-man shortlist now that will be discussed in the build up. And I just wanted to see if you thought, before we move on to the final part of Copa America, if you thought this could be the 5-man shortlist. So I've got Lionel Messi down, obviously, despite another Copa America heartbreak and a bit of a tantrum. Perhaps
they were two very bad decisions that didn't get.
This is what I mean. Perhaps it was rooted in Gabriel Jesus. We saw had a worse tantrum, arguably in tears. Lionel Messi completely dominant again on an individual level. Objectively, the best player in the world in terms of what he can do with a football. He is definitely going to be at least top five. He was last year.
Number 5.
Yeah, so we can see that repeating. I've got Virgil van Dijk down because obviously, again, ticks the box. Incredible stats that go with his that sort of voice, how good he was, and as well as picking up Champions League. I've put Alisson, as we said, for the things mentioned. And then Bernardo Silva, I feel, is probably the least likely, but he does tick all of the criteria that the Ballon d'Or use as their criteria.
Yeah.
And then obviously Cristiano Ronaldo will be in the top five.
Yeah.
Because it's him and he won some titles and the Nations League. Anyone else that you feel I've missed? Or do you think that is what people will now be discussing? Because Mohamed Salah knocked out of AFCON, so he's not going to have the international acclaim. Sadio Mane could potentially leapfrog him. Again, as Mo said, could be the split vote problem though with that. Do you think that's a potential Ballon d'Or shortlist?
Yeah, I'd say that sounds about right. But apart from Alisson, I don't think he's going to get enough votes to get in there. I just can't see it.
Just goalkeepers are a different breed.
Yeah, yeah. Like the reduced sort of number of goalkeepers out there compared to you know, midfielders, forwards, the competition. I think it would be a big ask.
And even Edison could be saying, hold on, if he's in there, I've got Premier League, I've got more titles.
Yeah. I think Kylian Mbappe will probably be in there because he's been brilliant this year, like really, really good. And I think he's now entered, which is weird because he's 20 years old, he's now entered that sort of Cristiano Messi thing where it's like he's just always going to be in the top five because he's one of the best. Like the same way Neymar was until his... Well, we'll go on to him in a minute, but...
That's what I was going to say. We can lead on that now.
You know, just...
Because in Neymar's absence, Everton and the player Everton, Little Onion, as his nickname translates...
He doesn't look like an onion. So.
No player scored more goals and he picked up the top goal scorer awards. I think Brazil picked up every single individual award. They were the best team, I guess. The fact they conceded one goal, scored the most, arguably. Yeah. But he was the player. Obviously, Willian was given Neymar's number 10 shirt, didn't really play. but it was the Little Onion that was sort of the breakout talent from the Copa America. And still playing in Brazil, we've seen the likes of Richarlison move, David Neres move, come to Europe. Everton could be the next one, Mo, do you think?
I mean, still playing in Brazil, I'm probably the only player in that squad that actually plays like a Brazilian. If you want to be honest with you, I mean, you watched him play. And again, this is the one thing, whatever you want to say about Neymar, we're all diving in theatrics, he plays like a Brazilian still, like with this flair, this incessant need to dribble at people and drive people, and this great skill and balance. And that's what Neymar, and then Everton had that same thing, had that same drive. He was constantly pushing. Remember Brazil, like, they were just sort of sluggish and kind of not really knowing what to do. And then he would pop. and he would just make something happen because he dribbled with the ball, was fearless with the ball, dribbling, running at opponents, taking them on, making them look fools, basically, you know, scored his goals as well, which is good. So yeah, he's, you know, it would blow my mind if he was still at Gremio in a month's time, because he's, I mean, I don't know who will sign him. I really hope it's someone good, because obviously there's always the risk with players like that, like, you know, where he blows up and then someone mid-table, he signs him just because they have a lot of money and he sort of fades into obscurity. Or like so many promising Brazilians went to Shakhtar like about 10, 15 years ago, and only really Fernandinho and Willian made it out. Like a lot of, no, there was some very good talent in Brazilians
like
then.
Tyson,
Alex Teixeira, you know, and even, to example, Douglas Costa. I mean, I know he's eventually made it out, but he could have been out earlier. So I'm really hoping he makes a good move where he goes, but he's really, really good. He's a great balance, great dribbling, great like attitude, just like drives his team forward. Doesn't necessarily need to
good
be...
good intent.
Yeah.
And it was also, as I said, Neymar didn't play. He wasn't there. Neymar does not have a copy. No matter what he does, he's not going to have that Copa America.
Nope.
Even if he's included in the squad, he can't do that. And Gabriel Jesus and Roberto Firmino started to play together and really click. I think a lot of people, Gabriel Jesus took a long time to score a competitive goal for Brazil, but was involved in the same way that Megan Rapinoe scored those four consecutive goals in the knockout stages. In the semi-final, Gabriel Jesus assist goal, and then he scored and assisted the first two in the final.
Mm-hmm.
Was later sent off, which completed a unique hat trick, and he was the first player to score and be sent off in the final.
Probably the first player to attack the VAR monitor as well.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That was the VAR can stay if more people
attack
if people are allowed to do whatever they want as they go off. You saw it wobbling over, didn't you?
If you make God bleed, he made VAR bleed. Everyone like, well, we can punch them on it now. We're allowed to do it.
He's exposed the weakness, but. Just a shout out to them, because obviously we've been talking about the Premier League focus, and they're sort of saying Alisson and Edison there, Man City Liverpool rivalry. At the other end of the pitch, Firmino and Jesus have always been battling for the number nine. They played together and they looked great. Firmino was in an even more reserved role, playing as an actual number 10.
Yeah.
Flanked by Coutinho and Everton. And it was fluid, but it was really good to see them play together, basically. And Gabriel Jesus, who has been handed the number 9 shirt for Man City for the next season.
That's a big statement of intent, considering how ropey he looked last season. But, you know, if he can build off this Copa, then he could be... I mean, you know, he was in Pep's first, in the 100-point season, he was better than Aguero.
Mm.
Like, you know, the way he played, he was amazing. But then, obviously, Aguero, to his credit... rallied and was excellent in the... I mean, you know, where it was good in both seasons, but you know what I mean? He was
the thing is,
Jesus out of the side in 18-19. So I think, you know, it's going to be a really good battle. It's really good for City, frankly.
Oh, it's amazing.
Because they need that depth. And also, Jesus also doesn't have to play a number 9 necessarily, can play wide if they need him to. So there's options there. City are... I mean, God, they're really good, aren't they?
Well, they're there for another podcast. We are going to take another little pause now just to give you all a chance to refresh. Or if you're hopping off on the commute, pause, come back to it. The next will be discussion of the man himself, Neymar. And Mo, as I said before the podcast, has been preparing a little winners and losers scenario for if he does go back to Barcelona. Before we begin the discussion about what might come next for Neymar within the realms of football itself, it would be ignorant of us to discuss the matter without addressing the off-pitch accusations that still loom over the Brazilian. On June 1st, Neymar was accused of raping a woman in a Paris hotel. The incident is reported to take place on May 15th. Neymar, of course, denied the claims and disclosed a large amount of a WhatsApp conversation between himself and the accuser with the aim of proving all interactions were consensual. The Office for the Investigation of Cybercrimes investigated the alleged video disclosure by the player, and the Instagram video was later removed by Instagram themselves, according to Neymar's father. BBC News report published on the 10th of June stated that the accuser's original lawyers walked away from her case, arguing that her initial complaint has been one of aggression or physical violence. Her second set of lawyers have set her a deadline to recover a video which she claims will prove the assault, having secretly filmed a later altercation on a tablet that was later reported stolen during a burglary on her house in Brazil. In a report by The Independent on July 2nd, it was stated that the Brazilian authorities are requesting more time to investigate the allegation further. 30 days have been reportedly allowed to continue the investigation, whilst the Rio de Janeiro police continue to investigate Neymar for posting the images of the accuser on social media without her authorization. But turning to the on-field matters, Neymar, who missed Brazil's Copa America win through injury, has now been subject of a strongly worded statement from his club, PSG. The French champions have promised to deal with the Brazilian forward in the appropriate manner following his unauthorized absence from the first day of preseason. Leonardo then revealed on Monday night that the Brazilian would be able to leave the club should the right offer be submitted, also admitting to tentative discussions with Barcelona about a possible return, but no mention of any bid being received at all. So with all that set as the platform, as I said, it's important to notice that that case is still ongoing and does exist. But we have asked Mo to talk about the footballing side of things here, to share his thoughts on the situation. As I said, winners and losers can be gleaned from this. But in the whole scenario, it looks like Neymar to Barcelona has taken another step to happening.
I mean, yeah,
and you'd prepared some stuff on this in recent weeks.
Yeah,
so I think you've got a lot to say.
The big winner of this whole situation is people that produce content around football, because Neymar to Barcelona is a huge story, and now we can just run that into the ground. He's a phenomenal footballer. Whatever one you want to say about his personal life, even before the whole accusation came up, he was a bit of a, you know, something. And it was just, you know, he rubbed people the wrong way. He became a meme at PSG because they, the one thing about Neymar has always been apparent, even when he was young at Santos, he's an excellent, excellent footballer, but he always had sort of a temper. He was always very short fused, very sort of given to bouts of immaturity, the kind of thing like winding up opponents, being very aggressive after matches. He started a fight after they won the Copa Libertadores. It's like beating up a Peñarol player. Like everyone thought this guy's going to implode. He's never going to make anything. And then what happened was he became a father. He had a child with a woman he wasn't married to, but he accepted paternity of this kid, and he was like, started raising him, and that seemed to mellow him out a little bit. And then he moved to Barcelona. Then he came under the influence of Messi, of Iniesta, Xavi at first, then later, you know, Suarez and Piqué and Busquets, and these professionals, these schoolboys, as Latin Ibrahimovic called them. And that really did a lot for him. It really calmed him down. A lot of the petulance went out of his game. Now, get me wrong, it was still there. He was still flicking the ball over the heads of Bilbao defenders and getting them mad with him. But it was much more manageable in a you know, footballing sense. And he seemed to grow up and mature into a kind of person that you'd think, okay, when he said, I'm going to leave for my own team, he sort of think, yeah, maybe he could do that, you know. But what happened was that without the guidance and the big brotherness, if you want to call it that, of Iniesta, of Busquets, of Piqué, of Messi, he just regressed completely at PSG. But there's no strong leadership culture at PSG. They thought they had one, but it turns out they just had Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Mm. You know, once he left, took it with him. There's no culture of leadership at PSG. It's just a culture of, I don't know what it is, you know, but they don't have a strong club culture. They don't have any strong leaders in the dressing room at all. Like, who's their biggest veteran? Thiago Silva? He's not a leader, you know. So it's just, yeah, then Neymar went into that environment and his petulance showed up. They spoiled him rotten from the start, you know. Yeah. The whole penalty thing with Cavani, they should have said at the start, no, he's taking penalties, you can have free kicks, sit down. But, you know, they let it fester. They sided with Neymar too much. And, he predictably went off the rails. You know, his focuses were always Brazil, the national team. You know, he basically took off. He had that surgery. He didn't, against Real Madrid, they lost the first leg. Obviously, he got injured in the first leg. He could have fought through the second leg on painkillers and just try out PSG. He's like, nah, you're all right, mate. Had surgery, just thought he'd be ready for the World Cup. You know, so his priorities have always been away from PSG itself. You know, and there's rumors that he was texting Bartomeu a year in January, like begging to come back. And that's they showed those texts to Frankie de Jong, apparently, and convinced him to. So, I mean, who knows if that's true. But
yeah, that's all part of the soap opera that this situation has
become. It does seem to now fit into what's happened. You know what I mean? At the time, you're thinking, that sounds a bit fanciful. But now you're like, oh, maybe it's true. Because the one thing I've always said is that PSG don't sell anybody unless they want to. And it's clear from what's happening now, they want to. Julian Lorenz obviously broke it a few weeks ago, saying that they want to sell Neymar. They think now's the right time. Now Leonardo's come out and said it. Like, yeah, well, if someone
offers... He hasn't come out and said it. Well, he's come out and said that...
Yeah, but the But that you don't
he
say
will
that about,
be sold.
You don't say that about
I know,
players
but
that
I
you
just
want to keep.
I just want people to realise that before they break a story saying Leonardo confirms Neymar wants to leave, it was very much of, we've had no offers. If the right bid that suits comes in, there is possibility to be sold. And I agree with you. You don't usually say that about someone that is completely invincible, as it were, in your squad.
I mean, look at how Atletico are handling Griezmann saying the same thing. They're falling apart over there. Like, they've been so petty. They gave his number away already. Now they're complaining about how he's being unprofessional, even though he's well within his rights to terminate his contract.
The thing with the Atletico Madrid statement you brought up is that they've said that the discussions with Barcelona, and remember, Griezmann's contract wasn't running out, so it's not you can talk to clubs. It was they were very unhappy with the fact that he was speaking to Barcelona during the Champions League campaign.
Yeah, everyone said it was. That's the sort of, everyone talks to everyone. That you don't make a beard.
I would just say that. I would just say it's very, Barcelona are allowed to be bad as well.
Oh no, they are. No. That's cheeky. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that they're paragons of virtue. I mean, the fact that they're going to try and sign Griezmann and Neymar in
this is the thing. Back into signings wise. They have Dembele. They have Coutinho.
Poor Dembele.
Neymar, who, when MSN was together, they scored 364 goals across all competitions in three seasons. Neymar scored 90 goals and provided 48 assists in that time.
Yeah.
They could be signing Griezmann, who's scoring 25 plus goals across all competitions pretty much every season now. They have one of the most prestigious young talents, and remember, Dembele is 22.
Who's shown up a week early for training, by the way, with Jean-Claire Todibo to get in and asked for a physio to help him through the season. So he's clearly aware of what's happening and taking steps to improve.
But this is the thing. Griezmann, as we said, is having that ridiculous situation at Atletico Madrid where, through fault of his own in wanting to do documentaries and wanting to bleed out the process of him leaving Atletico Madrid, is now left in complete limbo, in which they have reassigned his number to their 126 million euro wonder kid João Felix. So Griezmann either stays and has to adopt a new number, or he now is part of this merry-go-round in which, can Barcelona afford Neymar and Griezmann?
Well, I mean, this is the rumor is now that they've said to Atletico, can we pay the release clause in installments? Because obviously they're thinking, because now suddenly the possibility of signing Neymar's come. And this is the thing, we're talking about winners and losers here. Dembele is tentatively a big loser, but at the same time, Bartomeu has publicly expressed confidence in him, which is weird because it doesn't usually happen. And also, you know, Dembele is so good. It's just and so potentially brilliant that it would be really, really strange for a club to sort of ditch a player. He's 21 years old as well. He's young. I think a big loser here is Luis Suarez. Because I think with Griezmann, if Griezmann and Neymar do both come in, and I think at the moment it looks like that's going to happen, I think Luis Suarez suddenly finds himself nowhere near as untouchable as he was before. Because you've got, in Griezmann, he's not a number nine like Suarez is, but he can play number nine. He can play false nine with Messi. You've got Griezmann and Dembele, French players, great talents. Got Neymar. If he comes back, and I think, again, with Neymar, I know Leonardo hasn't said that he's going, but at the same time, you don't come out and say that your most talented player is for sale unless you want him.
Kylian Mbappe isn't for sale, though.
Hey, very good. but you know what? I love Kylian Mbappe, but look, let's not kill ourselves about how Neymar is a sensation. 51 goals, 27 assists at PSG, 78 goals in 58 games. That's ridiculous. In the Champions League, in that time, he's had completed 83 dribbles and created 44 chances. That's the first, more dribbles than anyone else. He's the third for chances created. And he's played just 13 games since then, right? He's got his per 90, with dribbles completed, is 6.43. That's more than anyone else. Chances created, 3.141, more than anyone else. He is incredible. Whatever you want to say about him as a person, you know, or the way he presents himself as a person, obviously none of us know him.
Yeah.
He seems like a bit of a, you know, so-and-so, but he is unquestionably, when he's fit, the second best player in the world. Like, there's no one even really close to him. Griezmann is probably the closest, maybe, or Cristiano Ronaldo. You know, those guys, they're really... But Neymar is ridiculous. What stops everyone from appreciating him is that he's such a...
Yeah, it's people can't...
Yeah, they can't look past the drama.
I don't think a player who is that good has ever been that disliked. Like, everyone seems to dislike Neymar now.
Yeah.
Everyone.
He needs Barca almost as a PR like cleanse, because once he goes back there, all the nonsense will dramatically decrease, because again, he'll be with Suarez and Piqué and Messi and the guys that kept him in check before.
Well, this is the thing. He left Barcelona, by all accounts, to emerge from Messi's shadow. This was the whole sort of narrative, and challenge Messi as the best player in the world. Perhaps it was good that he was cast in such a shadow, because being completely exposed has not gone well, as you said, for people forming their own opinions on him. At the World Cup, again, was brilliant on the ball, but as you said, transformed into a literal never-ending gif of him rolling on along the floor. Perhaps being in the spotlight, which he craves so much, is actually the worst possible thing that could have happened for Neymar's football career, because people have forgotten the individual brilliance that he has, which has then fed into his ego about wanting to remind people of that individual brilliance, and overdoing it and then getting kicked, which has led to the injuries.
I don't think that him sort of being injured, not playing as much, hasn't helped him there, because there's plenty of footballers out there who every week do something stupid off the pitch and get bad press, but then they score at the weekend and that dominates what happens. Yeah. But because he's been injured, it's just been the bad press.
Yeah.
If he was coming back and doing rainbow flicks, then...
Well, this is the thing is, when he returned and scored, he immediately got injured again.
If he is going to go back to Barcelona, then surely they're going to make him swallow it in a big way and have to say a statement apologising for his previous stance.
And
completely taking ownership of, I was wrong to come out and question the club and all that sort of thing. Mm. Because it's a bad look for Barcelona to have two players who are going to be worth big money not training ahead of potential moves to them. Like, it's just awful that that it just looks so bad on their image. You talk about it being positive PR. It's a disaster for them to be not training.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been Barcelona's thing, though,
Dembele,
isn't it?
That's the thing.
Yeah, Dembele, you know, Cesc as well did it. I mean, not to the same degree, but essentially Coutinho as well feigned an injury.
Yeah, I was going to say, we can't.
It's Barcelona's MO. They when they pursue a player and the club doesn't want to sell the player, they say, come on, put pressure on your club. And so the players do it, and they can do is they. You know, they go on strike, essentially. Now, I mean, that's not, again, that's where I would say Barcelona, that's not cool. They shouldn't do that. It's like, you know, just negotiate with the club, pay them what they want, and stop faffing around with the players, making them do all these unethical stuff. Yeah. So, and especially because it creates a bad sort of environment. Like Dembele, part of why he was so unprofessional in his first year at Barcelona is because that's how they got him to sign for the club.
Yeah, this is the whole thing. And obviously, we can't say Barcelona do this.
No,
none of it is proven at all, but there is a theme that people, when perhaps it's just the idea of wanting to play for Barcelona, that as soon as that becomes even a potential possibility, then players are doing everything they can to do that upon their own will. We didn't see Frenkie de Jong miss training.
That's true.
Matthijs de Ligt is back in training, and I know that might not be to Barcelona now, but this is what I'm saying. Barcelona interest does not immediately mean that players are missing clubs. Frenkie de Jong, Ajax bought that advert out. That is the most amicable. That's the most amicable transfer I've ever seen.
Yeah, they really,
between Ajax and Barcelona, you would expect it. To be.
But at the same time, they are losing. Like Jake says, that's their best player. That's like wow. But no, you know what? I think ultimately, look, to bring it back to the pitch, right? Because that's the most important part of it. I think ultimately, if Barca do bring him back, that you can only say it's good. It's only a good thing because he's so good. I mean, the wages situation, that will be hilarious to see how that works out. They'll have to cut some big wages. But the thing is, if they're going to sign him, it's not going to be straight cash. To get PSG to agree with it, they have to be offering players in return, because what is money to PSG? PSG don't need money.
Yeah.
They don't need it at all. It means nothing to them.
But again, this is another spanner in the works, because PSG have gone on a quite... not odd transfer recruitment drive, but almost sensible in the fact that they've picked up the joint leading assist maker in La Liga for under 20 million euros. Pablo Sarabia has joined. Ander Herrera has joined on a free.
And as a backup.
This is what I'm saying. For a team that was playing Dani Alves in midfield, makes complete sense.
I was going to say, Sarabia is a very, very canny move, because Angel Di Maria is 32 now. So he's getting on a bit. Injured place in Tarek Sarabia as a hand and glove fit for that. I think you look at the team, if you are going to get rid of Neymar, you have a wing, you're opening on that left wing for a creative player who can create chances for Mbappe. You know, Coutinho fills that role quite nicely. Would probably relish being a team where he's the primary playmaker. As we saw with Liverpool, he needs to be the one taking the most touches on the ball. When he's not, he struggles with Barcelona, for Messi has that role. And then Rakitic, I think, would be a phenomenal... You add Rakitic to Paredes and Verratti, And suddenly PSG have a very good midfield. Yeah. It's very solid. It's very hard to play through and can play with the ball itself. So I think if I'm Barcelona, you need to sort your wages out and you need to get your Neymar back. Because, I mean, it's pretty obvious that PSG are close to washing their hands with Neymar. It seems that way. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
I'm saying, you know, you give them like 80 million, the money you have for Delict. You say, here's 80 million, 100 million, and Coutinho and Rakitic. That's a transfer that exceeds 220 million in value.
It's like 300, isn't it?
Yeah, when you consider the players. So that's for me, that's what I do, because that would you get rid of Coutinho, who's not really ever going to play well in Barcelona. You get rid of Rakitic, who is just right now in Frankie De Jong and Ricky Pucci's way.
Yeah.
And then you get Neymar back. And then on top of that, you play Griezmann's release clause, and then he can just, you know, eventually fade out Suarez. And then you've got your new front three, but also you've got Dembele, so you've got a front four.
That is a very Barcelona-centric idea world. Yeah. Dream scenario for Barcelona.
The MAN, that will be.
Well, I don't know what it'll be, mate. But alternatively, if you do sign Neymar and you can't sign Griezmann, Bayern Munich recently got rid of Frank Ribery. Their number seven shirt is just sitting there. And they need a player, a left foot, and they recently got rid of Arjen Robben, a left-footed wing forward.
So... Interesting. I was going to say, if I'm PSG and Neymar wants to go, and as you said, money is not a value of anything, give me Ousmane Dembele.
Well,
let me reunite him with Kylian Mbappe. Yeah. Let the French champions have a French forward line that is dominant. Then say, Barcelona, you can't now afford Griezmann. We know Atletico Madrid want to sell Griezmann. They're giving away his number. Hold on. Let's just have a French front three.
Give Mbappe the 10, give Griezmann the 11, give Dembele the 11, give Griezmann the 7.
You know what? And again, as I said, for someone that has so much love for a player of Edinson Cavani's career and ability, he can either stay or, as I said, he can fulfill our dream of joining Atletico Madrid.
Oh, yes.
Or something like that. So the transfer... This transfer merry-go-round is very much going to be one of that because of Neymar. There are so many more options. I'm sure Mo will be producing some written content on this subject matter as well. But as I said, that is all we're going to have time for this week. Sorry that it was a day late, but I hope it was well worth that wait. Leads me to just say thank you, Mo, for joining us.
Thank you, Jet, for hosting.
Sam, thank you for joining us.
Cheers, mate.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. Rate, review, subscribe, and join us again next time.
Man.